This is Scott Becker with the Becker Private Equity and Business Podcast. Thrilled today to be joined by two brilliant money managers, wealth advocates. We're joined today by Alan Cole and Chris Engelman. They're with the firm Parkside Investments, and both brilliant. We're going to talk to them today about whether they have a core investment philosophy, how they work with people, how they look at the markets, what key metrics they think about, and also just about the founding of their firm. They've both been in the business for a very long time, but founded a new firm several years ago. We'll talk about that as well. Alan, can you take one moment to introduce yourself, and I'll ask Chris to do the same. Alan?
Sure. First off, Scott, I just want to thank you for the opportunity of having us on your podcast. As for me, I've been in the investment business a little over 20 years after spending some time at Ford Motor Company and at U.S. Bank in a variety of financial roles. I started Parkside Investments back in the beginning of 2017, and I am currently the president and chief investment officer for our firm.
Fantastic. And Chris, can you take a moment and introduce yourself? Then, Alan, I do want to go back for a second and ask you about Ford Motor Company, a little bit more about that as well. But Chris, can you take a moment to introduce yourself?
Sure. And I'm Chris Engelman. I've actually been in the investment business for almost 25 years now, where first on the traditional institutional side, and now I'm more on the high net worth family side, where I've really sort of evaluated both traditional investments as well as alternatives, including hedge funds, private equity, real estate, and other asset classes, where we're trying to make our clients money without taking excessive amounts of risk here.
And Chris, let me ask you a question about that for a moment. How much of your clients, when you're working through portfolios, are you working with them on publicly traded vehicles, alternative investments? What's the mix of what you work with your clients and so forth today?
It really runs the gamut from traditional stocks and bonds to alternatives and private investments, really sort of focusing on what does the client need in order to accomplish their goals and what they're looking to do. Now, some of those goals could be very quantitative in nature and making sure that they don't lose too much money. Other than is much more qualitative in nature, being, you know, does this feel like the right thing to do here? And it really sort of depends on the client, and where appropriate for the client, we're more than happy to do alternative investments, and where not appropriate, we just stick traditional stocks and bonds.
And just to that point, on sourcing alternative investments, I mean, the world of money management has changed a lot over the last 20, 30 years. People used to have to be at large firms. Now a ton of people do it, and great, great businesses do it at small firms because they've got the software and the ability to do so. Sourcing sort of alternative investment. Just 2 seconds on that, Chris, and I want to turn it back to Alan for a few questions for Alan. How do you sort of look at alternative investments and so forth? Can you talk about that for a moment?
Sure, Scott, that's a really good question, because I think there's a lot of people out there these days promoting alternative investments as sort of the bright, shiny star, where everyone's talking about how interest rates are very low and you're not going to make any money, and valuations on traditional equities are really high, and so you're not going to make any money out of there. And lo and behold, alternative investments or private equity or hedge funds are going to be the new best thing, and that's where you're going to be making all your money. We've been doing this for over 2 decades. And in reality, a lot of these private investments are very much tied to the public equity and fixed income markets here. So we're a little bit skeptical of that claim of these are the new bright, shiny stars. In some cases, yes, they are going to work. But in many cases here, they may be the same, similar challenges as you're seeing in the public investments from stocks and bonds as well.
No, and I think that's it, very, very true. And Alan, let me ask you a question, because talk about sort of, you know, people have done all these studies of, you know, just investing in S&P 500s versus more of a managed approach. And then, you know, people look at these illiquid approaches, and is there really an alpha in using the illiquid approaches? And would you want to take a moment and talk about sort of the core investment philosophy that you bring to the business and game? I know you as an extremely thoughtful, extremely intelligent person. How do you sort of look at this? Is there a core investment philosophy that you bring to this?
Yeah, there is. You know, I think, you know, you touched on a little bit about the whole active versus passive investing. And, you know, investments go through cycles and strategies go through good cycles and bad cycles. And, you know, we've certainly gone through a period where, because of all the liquidity that's been pushed into the markets by the Fed and by other entities, we've seen a rising tide lift all boats. And in some cases, it's lifted the benchmarks, which can be very concentrated in just a few individual names and a few individual very large names, has pushed valuations to very high levels. And this is not that dissimilar to what occurred 20 some odd years ago, back in the dot-com bubble, where there was the go-go growth phase that was stretching valuations very high, and a period of time where passive investing did much better than active investing, only to have it all reverse in a very extreme way, and active management being much more positively return-oriented than passive investments, certainly in the beginning of the 2000s. And we think that we could be in a very similar period now. You know, our strategy is sort of to look at businesses from the prism of three different perspectives as we look at just specific, you know, equity investments. And that is to look at them from a business standpoint, how they're operated, how strong is their management team, do they have the resources to continue on, as well as look at what are the industry dynamics, what are good industries to be in, what are bad industries, because there's just too much competition and potentially not enough profits to go around. And the final core tenet is valuation. So we do have a valuation thread throughout what we do, but it doesn't mean that we only are looking at valuation as the sole purpose of looking at an investment in terms of its merits.
And so you look at sort of the business itself, the business, the management team, its own business, the industry that it's in, and then finally the valuation. Is it valued properly, too low, too high, and so forth? And then, Ellen, how much thoughts do you do with clients around allocation of assets between equities, bonds, cash, et cetera, and how do you approach that from a client perspective?
You know, it's probably the most important issue when we work with our clients. We treat all of our clients as individuals. We don't really subscribe to the model portfolio methodology. So every client is unique in terms of what their needs are, what their tolerances are, where they are in terms of accumulating assets or later in life as they're looking to live off of their portfolios for their living expenses. So all those factors play into a part in terms of what their overall asset allocation is. We have some clients who are entirely equities because that is appropriate for them. We have others on the other extreme that have mostly bonds, even though bonds are not providing much of a income or return right now, but safety is paramount in their minds. And obviously, there's a whole host of clients who are in the middle. But the decision is really going to be based on Chris or I having direct conversations with those clients to really determine what the appropriate mix is for them.
And take a moment on your history. I mean, starting out at Ford Motor Company, it must be a fascinating sort of movement from there into wealth and money management. And then talk to us a moment about stress, anxiety, excitement of starting Parkside.
Sure. Well, it seems like a long time ago, but I did work for Ford Motor back in the late 80s and early 90s. There, I had a host of financial roles, and probably the one that sticks most in my mind was when I was involved in the asset-backed securitizations that auto companies were involved with, and we would work with investment banks in order to sell these large pools of assets, billions of dollars of assets. And I would sit at the table, and opposite me would be people from the investment community asking questions of me as to what was going on with the business and what are our loss ratios, et cetera, and what were some of the trends involved. And I enjoyed what I was doing, but I really liked what the investment banks were doing in terms of asking questions. And it really got me thinking about how I could use my curiosity, as well as my knowledge of working for a publicly traded company, to help me try to get under the hood of publicly traded securities and find out what's going on with them, what are some of the motivations that are going on with the various businesses, how they act competitively. And so that sort of was the launching of me wanting to get into the investment business. There was no straight path, so I had to take a couple of stops along the way before I finally got a chance to work at an investment advisory firm and really pursue my desire of wanting to be a portfolio manager and work with clients in helping meet their investment needs.
And when you think about this mix of investment professionals, you think about, I think of you as there's this whole mix of people that are very sales oriented, very, very thoughtful and analytic oriented. I obviously think of you as extremely thoughtful and analytic. How did that set of skills work as you built your own firm and so forth, and Chris built it with you? How did you guys sort of approach the market and so forth? And you've had great success in this business over a long period of time. You're sort of the antithesis of what people think of as sort of a hustling sales guy. You're a very thoughtful, analytical person. Chris is also a very gifted, brilliant person. How did that work as you started to accumulate assets, accumulate clients, build a business? What was that like? Was that exciting? Was it nerve-wracking? How did that develop and evolve?
Well, I think it was all of the above. You know, we, as you intimated, I'm more on the analytical side, at least initially. That was certainly what I felt was my strength. And, you know, after being in the business a while, I recognized that there needed to be more than just being somebody who would pick individual securities or create portfolios or asset allocations, that there really was a relationship side to it. And so it took me a while, call it 5 years, to start to feel more comfortable to sort of move in that direction and have that be an important aspect of what I do. And I think Chris and I are probably, you know, similar in that regard, that we certainly were more on the analytical side at first and then moved and recognized the value of having the relationships and really getting a lot of, you know, reward from working with people and helping solve problems that they have or address situations that they don't necessarily feel comfortable with. But certainly as that process went through, there's stress involved because sometimes things don't work out the way in the markets that you want them to. And people confront challenges along the way, and helping them through those periods can be a challenge, but it also can be hugely rewarding.
I think one of the things that goes underestimated here, at least not taught in business school when you're studying all this, is the responsibility that goes that's associated with managing people's money. You know, after their family and after their health, their money is the most important thing to them. And being responsible for that and having them put the trust in you is a great responsibility, and you want to make sure that you don't let them down. And so being able to work with your clients to have them understand what's going to happen in the portfolio over the long term, but also what's going to happen when markets start to get rocky, and this is how we're going to get through that. If you're able to do that, you're going to get the client focused on the long term, get them through those rocky periods, and feel that sense of, I accomplished something and I helped them accomplish their goals in many ways of, you know, their goal is to preserve their lifestyle. And if we can do that for them, well, that feels that tremendous satisfaction from helping them accomplish that goal.
And Chris, let me ask you a different question. Alan had referenced the dot-com era and different eras that, you know, we've all been around long enough to watch the Alan Greenspan era, where interest rates were extremely low, assets were highly inflated, and then they came back down significantly as rates went back up. How many parallels are there to that today when you look at Chairman Powell trying to you know, trying to keep asset prices rational and in what people think of as a highly inflated era, and at the same time start to peer back bond buying and start to raise rates, take back a little bit of the Fed balance sheet. What are the things that you're watching over this next year? And, you know, you excited, concerned? How do you sort of look at this as it's handled from a Fed perspective? Because it's such a macro impact on everything, doesn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely. The Fed and interest rates are absolutely dictating where the market has been over the last, you know, we'll call it 5, even 10 years, let alone the two plus years of COVID now that we're in. The one big parallel that we see back between 2000 and today is there's a certain pocket of stocks really driving the market. Today, what you have, not back in 2000, it was absolutely the tech stocks driving the market higher. Today, it's the tech stocks, but it's also the five or six sort of FANG plus stocks that are very much driving the market that now represent about over 30% of the S&P 500. When you take out those stocks here, and if you take out a few others, sort of what I'll call tech money losing companies, the rest of the market seems to be selling at a very reasonable valuation here. That was very similar to what we saw back in the late 90s. And when that reversed back in March of 2000, what you saw is value stocks actually increase over the next few years, while those growthy tech names declined significantly. When we look at the market today, we think that we're in a very similar type situation where you may actually see the market continue to grind higher. I don't necessarily think that you're going to see the types of returns over the next 3 years that we've experienced over the last 3 years, but the market could very well grind higher with a lot of these tech names, unfortunately, declining, while a lot of the neglected value names actually increasing in price here.
There's so much interesting there that you just spoke about. When you look at this, there's five stocks that have been responsible for a huge substantial amount of the S&P gains. And what you and Alan have pointed out, which is very interesting, is this concept that, look, there's a lot of names beyond those five, beyond the Apples, the Googles, and the Nvidias, et cetera, Alphabet, you know, et cetera, that are Tesla, that are not as overvalued, where there is room for those to keep on doing well in a cyclical environment. I mean, a fascinating perspective. Let me ask you another question or follow-up question. You know, people traditionally looked at the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ, and sort of the S&P and the NASDAQ, there's a lot of similarities, there's some divergence. Is the NASDAQ a little bit more tech-heavy? But I guess a question for you is the Dow still relevant, or does it really come down to really looking at individual names or broad indexes? And how do you look at the Dow? Is the Dow directionally relevant, or is it not really relevant at all anymore?
I think directionally is absolutely relevant, but it's not the end-all be-all. There, as you pointed out, there are various other indices, whether it's the NASDAQ or the S&P 500 or even some small-cap indices, the S&P 600, the Russell 2000. We like to look at a combination of all those to figure out how the market is doing and what we think is going to happen. More importantly, what do we think is going to happen going forward and where do we want to be invested from that perspective? But to the extent that the Dow being 30 large cap stocks, most of those being multinational stocks, you know, I don't necessarily think that's so representative of the greater 5,000 plus stocks that are out there in the universe.
Thank you. And Alan, a question for you. Assuming you could discount Syracuse and Duke, do you pick more as a stock picker, someone from WashU or from Vanderbilt?
Probably Vanderbilt.
Fair enough. And Chris, any thoughts there?
Vanderbilt's actually a very good school. I'm not going to ever talk badly about Vanderbilt. That's per se.
Right. No, I know that I say this facetiously because I know that one of you is a Vanderbilt grad, one of you is a WashU grad, both brilliant, brilliant people. Alan, any other things that you're watching going into 2022 that people should be thinking about as they look at the markets?
Well, right now there's so many issues that are confronting the markets and investors, going from coronavirus to all the business disruptions from having employees partially in the office or out of the office and the supply chain issues that are founding a lot of different industries. But, you know, notwithstanding all of those, I think the most important focus from a market and investment perspective is probably the Federal Reserve and their monetary policy. And how are they going to navigate withdrawing some or all of the liquidity that they put into the markets over the past 2 years, and you could argue, as Chris mentioned earlier, over the past 10 years. You know, I think that moving from an easy money policy to something that clearly is not that easy, and the question is how tight, is going to be the thing to look at, particularly as it relates to just what's driving the markets. It may be a little bit less economic sensitive and more based purely on Fed policy.
When you think about this, when I think about the pluses of Fed Chairman Powell, I would say that the biggest plus is he's been pretty clear about here's where we're going as a Fed. And how helpful to that is that to people like you that are helping to manage people's money? I mean, there's still a lot of uncertainty, of course, but he's done a very good job of sequencing and saying where he's going with it. Is that helpful?
You know, it's there's two sides to it, because I think it is helpful that there's a lot more communication, but whether it borders on too much communication and whether signals are being mixed, I think is an open question. I think he has a very tough job, just as Yellen had a tough job before him and the others prior to Chair Yellen. But my feeling is that they will probably move forward, not nearly as fast as what maybe today people believe, but we're entering an unknown area. I mean, the massive amount of liquidity that's in the markets is unprecedented, and how they get out from under it is going to be a challenge.
Your point, though, because I think this is right on, is they've really literally accumulated $8 trillion in assets on the Fed balance sheet over the last couple of years, I mean, and more than over the last 5 to 10 years. But they can't unwind that too quickly. I mean, what he's talked about is paring back. There's going to slow down purchasing more to add to it, and that's going to get done in the next couple of months. But they can't unwind that very quickly without really causing upheaval in the market, can they?
It seems to be a challenge. And every time that they've seemingly wanted to go down the path, they sort of stop and reverse course. You think back to 2018 at the end of the year, where it seemed like they were about to go on a tightening phase, and the markets certainly weren't receptive to how aggressively they felt like Chair Powell was going to move. Unclear whether that type of reaction may occur again, but you know, right now you've got a yield curve that is relatively flat. Long-term rates are not that much higher than the short-term interest rates. And, you know, to our way of thinking, looking at the slope of the yield curve is going to be an important indicator as to whether the market believes, one, that the Fed has a handle on inflation, and two, whether they are managing the withdrawal of liquidity in an appropriate way. And, you know, right now, anybody's guess is as good as the next person's. That's going to be the challenge, and certainly something that we are going to be watching on, because that's going to be a good indicator as to how much risk people are willing to make in the risk markets, being the equities, bonds, crypto, you name it.
And Chris, to go to Alan's point earlier, asset allocation becomes as important as ever, as people have to have an asset allocation they could live with if things go in the wrong direction a little bit. I mean, you have to have an asset allocation that doesn't cause you to immediately pull your stock holdings, so then you end up missing out on very impossible almost to time the markets. And so asset allocation becomes more and more important, doesn't it?
It absolutely grows more and more important. And the other thing that I think people need to focus on is setting realistic expectations, and the fact that equities over the next decade are going to likely produce significantly lower returns than what they have over the future decade, or what they've had over the past decade. And in doing that, you're going to have to look at your spending habits for high net worth families, at least, and say, let's set some realistic spending habits to match what the returns are going to be most likely over the next decade's worth of returns.
And it's not just about your returns. It's about you controlling one's spending as well, to sort of like, get wealthy and then stay wealthy. And part of that's just controlling spending and expenditures as well.
Absolutely. You gotta control both sides of your balance sheet.
Fascinating perspective. And I want to ask you one more question. You talk about Federal Chairman Powell and Eleanor Chris. Clearly, Fed policy can very quickly impact valuations of stocks and valuations of real estate. In the old days, it was thought that Fed policy could also very quickly impact inflation. Is there more of a disconnect between the ability of the Fed to impact inflation on general supply and demand versus assets like stocks and real estate? I mean, is the Fed still an inflation fighter when so many of the issues seem to be supply and demand issues versus in supply chain issues? I mean, do they still have the same impact there in fighting inflation without taking a big, hatchet to it?
I'll address, part of that. I think Chris can probably speak a little bit better on maybe the real estate aspect of it. I do think that some of the inflationary pressures, a lot of them, are a result of the shutdowns in the economy and COVID and changing in consumer habits, as there's been a rush to move away from travel because of concerns over the virus and buying of goods, as people are looking for ways to spend the money that they've received. So, I think that there are certain bottlenecks and other pressures in commodity world that are not going to be addressed by Fed policy. And some of them, I think, will work themselves out. There's a saying in the commodities markets that the cure for high prices is high prices. And generally that just means that demand destruction will occur as the prices crowd some of the demand out. So I think that will probably have a better impact on reducing inflation in certain pockets of the economy better than what Fed policy may dictate.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's the $8 trillion or $80 trillion question, but that is the question to be asking these days of, can the Fed control inflation with their interest rate policies? And if they're successful here, we should have a pretty good decade going forward. And if they're not successful, well, then it's going to be a little more rocky road kind of going forward.
Right. It seems like they certainly control inflation in equities and real estate, because there seems to be a pretty direct correlation between what they do and what happens with those. But it seems less clear to me that they could have an impact on oil and gas prices or other types of things by changing interest rates. But I guess we'll see how that plays through. But what a fascinating perspective. Alan Cole, Chris Engelman, Parkside Investments, thank you for taking the time to visit with us today on the Becker Private Equity Podcast. Just a pleasure to hear your perspectives and think through and talk through some of these issues. I know I took a little bit more of your time than we expected. I appreciate you joining us very, very much.
Thank you, Seth. We really appreciate it.